This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
It's Friday, December 9th, 2016. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. The president of South Korea, Park Geun-hye, has been impeached. She tried to ride her 4% popularity to a different fate. Nope, didn't happen. President Park's undoing seemed to center around her relationship with a childhood friend, perhaps her only friend, who might have also been a cult leader. It turns out that Park, the daughter of a former president, shows that growing up in a cloistered palace with few friends or contact with the outside world is not the perfect incubator for determining the needs of a burgeoning democracy. Take note, Barron Trump, 2048 campaign. But it was this sentence about Park that struck me as interesting. Chung Jin-suk, Korean member of Congress, described the toll the ordeal was taking on the president. Quote, she said a few times she was sorry. She has grown noticeably wan. Which, considering that Korea's unit of currency is the won, is like saying of an American president, that guy is money. He's so money, he doesn't even know it. It makes no sense. Oh, okay. Wan, W-A-N, not W-O-N. Well, the impeachment coming on the heels of allegations of corruption and misappropriation is indeed a hard-won victory. And in other international news, Boris Johnson, Foreign Secretary of the UK, has been chastised in public by Theresa May, the Prime Minister there. It has just surfaced that last week Boris spoke out of school at a conference in giving his assessment of Saudi Arabia's role in the Middle East. May objected to the description Johnson gave Saudi Arabia as an ally, and I have to say, I heard about this news, and I knew about Johnson's history of bumbling missteps and forehead-smacking misstatements, and I was just bracing for what Johnson was going to say. Well, the BBC aired it, and here it is.
There are politicians who are twisting and abusing religion and different strains of the same religion in order to further their own political objectives, and that's one of the biggest problems in the whole, political problems in the whole region. You've got the Saudis, the Iran, everybody moving in and puppeteering and playing proxy wars. And it's a tragedy to watch it. We need to have some way of encouraging visionary leadership in that area. People who can tell a story that brings people together from different factions and different religious groups into one nation.
Boris Johnson, who once won a contest by writing a poem that insinuated that Turkey's President Erdogan had sexual relations with a goat, once called Africans flag-waving pickaninnies. Boris Johnson, I expected worse. That is the statement that got Boris Johnson a rebuke. And the U.S., our incoming national security advisor, spreads Hillary Clinton pizza parlor sex ring conspiracy stories. And the punishment is that his son has to revert to his Gmail account. Just wow. On the show today, it is an Antan Twig. Awards will be given. Forgiveness will be sought. And we have a Slate Plus segment. To sign up for Slate Plus, go to slate.com/gistplus. In it, I will explore the origins of Frosty the Snowman with a man from the supposed hometown of the ambulatory snow person. The man is Dave Barry. He's a famous Floridian. He will be speaking about Frosty, a mythical snowman. But first, comedian Kyle Kinane. He's by turns profound and profane. That rhymes. I expected a hurricane of hairy-chinned turbulence when Kyle sat down, but I found the guy just to be quite lovely, and I hope you agree.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know ya at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
There's so many showbiz types, like, the most important thing is just that you vote. You're not telling me to vote. You're telling me to vote for Hillary.
Yeah.
Stop acting like you're just filled with civic pride right now.
Exactly.
You want me to vote for somebody. Just tell me who you want me to vote for. Don't tell me the most important thing is to vote. Because if I say, cool, I'm going to vote for Trump, you're going to say, don't vote. You'll ruin America.
On this show, I was talking about the one unifying thing is the message, get out and vote, and how proud everyone it is and how inspiring it is to see the I voted sticker. But if right under I voted, you put for Trump?
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be the least inspiring thing.
It's like my friend literally did that at her work, like added her own thing, like for Trump, like hilarious office gag that nobody liked at all today.
Yeah.
That's maybe, my problem.
Maybe at noon it was funny.
Yeah, that's my problem. I just don't veil it like it's just civic American rah-rah pride.
Right.
You're telling me who to vote for.
Well, you know what? And we're speaking with Kyle Kinane. His new special is Loose in Chicago. It airs at midnight October 15th on Comedy Central. I usually don't do the rolling comedian podcast start.
Yeah.
Like, you know how
well, that's all right.
WTF does it. And
yeah,
how,
yeah. And here we are. We've just been hanging.
Yeah. No, actually, it is rolling. So we're talking about voting and
time travel since that came out 3 weeks ago.
Oh, yeah. It airs on October 15th.
God, if time travel were real, now's the time to tell people, hey, you really need to vote?
You need to have a little 10 minutes in that special on what's at stake, dude. Well, also, did you nail the Cubs thing in that special?
No, I mean, I recorded at a place called the Metro, which is directly across the street from Wrigley Field.
I know.
And it was in May, so I was like, all right, got to make sure there's no games going on. And I recorded at a venue that I've been going to see all ages of shows at since I was 15. I remember being some, like, this resentment for the Cubs of being, you know, a 17-year-old punk rocker and then all these jocks in the neighborhood because you'd forget that there's a band you wanted to see the same night as a game. You're like, all the money you were going to pay to somebody that was over 21 to buy you beer, you had to pay for parking instead.
Yeah, but I actually think of all the teams, there's definitely an indie rock overlap with
well,
the Cubs.
Well, that's been one of the discussions now is what happens post-lovable loserism, post 108 years.
They lost their brand. It was a stupid move.
That, yeah, it was their brand was being losers. And that's why I could identify. I don't play sports. I didn't grow up with sports. I didn't have dads or grandparents that were like, this is our team, this is a family team. I had none of that. All I had was like, oh, you guys, year after year, like, yeah, what a disappointment. That I could relate to. In any form, I'm like, oh, you let a bunch of people down. I got that one. I'm familiar with that feeling. So, all right, go Cubs.
Well, I was thinking about this in your own life. You're having a run of success, great success, deserved success, yet your brand is, you know, has the elements of the schlub loser in it.
Yeah, I don't want to be disingenuous. I don't want to become, as my friend coined it, a hipster Larry the Cable Guy, where this guy, I'm just like, no, you're a millionaire. Your name's Dan, and get some sleeves. So I'm not going
to. And you're from Nebraska, by the way.
There's a lot
of authenticity with Larry the Cable Guy. Not named Larry, doesn't work in cable, isn't from the South.
Your character. I don't want to be disingenuous myself. Boy, man, I can't. I sure did. Such a loser. Like, no, I'm 39 now. I am trying to take care of myself. Like, hopefully the brand is just, I'm going to be completely honest about what's happening in my life on stage.
Yeah.
And if that makes me less relatable to some people, well, I'm sorry. I'm not going to lie to you and be like, boy, it sucks, man, being broke and nothing goes right. No, things are going well. I get to tell jokes for a living. I'm very ecstatic about that.
It's not as if, though, women have stopped sighing in your face while you're having sex.
No, I got a nice lady now who, if she does sigh in my face, I know it's temporary. And you're right. You're absolutely right. And we'll have a laugh about this a little bit later.
Yeah, but there are a number of comedians who are in that boat and they start off as one thing and they get successful. And I think a number of artists, you know, Springsteen, and the art is nothing to do with, if the art is entirely dependent on I am from this milieu, then it's a gimmick. And you could be successful. I guess Larry's successful. Not to shit all over Larry the Cable Guy, but someone great like Louis C.K., he didn't have much. Now he has a lot, and he jokes about the stuff he has. So it's great.
Another friend of mine, John Roy, a comic from Chicago, was another. Said, if you can make me laugh at a different viewpoint, like especially speaking now in this political climate, mm-hmm. if you can make a joke about a thing I don't agree with you on, but the joke's funny enough, that's good comedy. And so to hear somebody that's incredibly wealthy joking about being wealthy, but you can still laugh at, like, that's good. It was Drew Carey. I would see Drew Carey in Elliott's show, and he'll drop in on whatever show, and he's a very nice guy, but he's like, you want to tax more because rich people? No, I worked hard and I earned this money. I complain about this to my maid all the time. And she'll finish her shift, but I'll dump some chips on the floor, keep her around pair time and a half. But I'll tell her, like, listen, Lupa, you don't understand. I don't deserve to be taxed as much. Like, you made me laugh yep. at a joke about being incredibly wealthy.
Because I guess when a comedian starting off, the recognition laugh is nice, but you don't want it anymore. You don't want the clap laughter. Necessarily. No. Yes, you said the thing that was true.
Yeah, or just like going on stage. What challenge is that in life to go up and agree with your audience? Great comic, my name is Sam Jay, who's a married black lesbian. I saw her do a bit where she defended old, rich, white, racist dudes. Like, I get it. You know, you lost a leg in Korea and you just want to sit in your house and be racist. You fought for the right to be racist. Now everybody's like telling you can't even be racist in your own house. You're like, I went to war to be racist. I fought for the right to be racist. I get that. And I was like, what a refreshing viewpoint. Like, you took somebody else's perspective and defended it, even though it goes against yours. It's high school debate class stuff. But it's a great writing exercise.
It's more exciting for you.
Yeah. I love, like, why, if I hate something, so many comedians, I hate this and it sucks. And they say, well, if you don't like it, how would you fix it? Or defend, like, take that side for yourself and try to understand that side.
When this started, we were talking about the I voted sticker. And it strikes me that you, specifically for what you do, and I'm going to use the word specifically again, mm-hmm. the reason that just saying I voted and eliding the for who part, which is the whole reason for voting, right?
Yeah.
It's not like I voted, but only for municipal elections. I voted only for municipal court judge. You voted for president because you wanted one of those two people to be president. It's just that so much of comedy in your comedy depends on specificity. Yeah. And when you go around the specificity, when it's, Katy Perry saying, get out there and vote for someone, it's offensive to you. Get specific.
Well, any propaganda from any side, I don't like. And I saw a lot of stuff that was happening on Twitter where people were saying, if you vote third party, you're trash. You're like, how could you can't be more undemocratic and un-American than telling somebody their vote is garbage? You can't tell somebody to participate and then tell them they're wrong for the way they're participating.
This points out to me that stand-up comedy is, in a way, the most idealistic profession, because you don't have to get along. You don't have to get along with a group. You don't have to make compromises.
Yeah. I don't think I had like a list of careers laid out for me. Like, doctor, nah. Lawyer, nah. You know what? Jokes for beer and peanuts, nah. I didn't have anything else going on, so I kind of fell into it.
You grew up a little outside of Chicago.
Yeah, western suburbs of Chicago.
Did you go to college?
Yeah, I went to three of them.
Yeah? Did any of them stick?
The last one, I went to a community college, I went to state school, and I went to Columbia College in Chicago. Oh. I went there long enough to where they're just after, I forget, 6 years there, I think, was like, you're done. I was like, oh, no, I don't want to be done. I like it. It's liberal arts. I'm just taking fun stuff. I had no curriculum I was following. I'm like, no, you have enough credits. Like, you're getting a bachelor's degree. I was like, ugh. And so I moved to LA. Like, I got the degree and I took off.
Yeah. Did you do stand up in college?
Yeah, that's where I started. I started when I was 22.
That's older than some comedians that I hear of. To me, it seems normal. We're roughly the same age.
Nowadays,
but you hear some of these guys, 17.
Well, yeah, and I don't know where, I didn't even know where to go for stand-up. I mean, I didn't know. You'd see it on TV, but especially when you're a teenager or something, I didn't relate to, this guy's in blazers talking about their wives. Like, I like what they're doing. I was always mystified from an early age of, staying up late watching Johnny Carson. Like, that guy's the only thing, they just introduce him by name and he just stands there and talks. Mm-hmm. He's not in a band. He's not doing magic. He's not in movies. He's just talking to people and they laugh, and he got on TV because of that. That seems like the most, in my head, I'm like, that's the quickest way to success. I don't even have to learn anything. I just got to talk. Yeah. I can already do that as a human being. Yeah. Let me give that a shot. So,
was your style starting off different from it is now? Not more refined, but different persona?
Yeah. I was never like a very loud, like, okay, parties, I was a loud, obnoxious guy. You look back and you're like, oh man, I sure was fun at parties. Like, nah, you're a jerk.
Yeah.
You're just a loud
you're
jerk.
You're liquored up.
You forced people to listen to you. But when I started stand up, it was from a writing standpoint. So it was guys like Mitch Hedberg that, like, the economy of words that they use to put a joke out there. I was like, that's fascinating to me. Like how you can refine something down to two sentences. So I had zero personality on stage. And I thought if I could just deliver it in writing, that if people laughed at the writing of it, then maybe I can start trying to sell it and have some salesmanship. And that eventually gave way to I'm mostly salesmanship, and the writing has totally fallen off.
Well, I want to play. So we're going to play this, and this is some of your set on a recent Conan.
I do. I have conspiracy theories, but my conspiracy theories are so low rent, I can't even hang out with the actual conspiracy theorists because they don't want to entertain my notions. I'm like the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer of conspiracy theories. They're all in the clubhouse in the corner going over the real stuff. Like, of course, the moon landing was fake because we had to beat Russia during the Cold War up there no matter what the cost. And I try and jump in like, yeah, and I think that Trader Joe's is making their parking lots too small on purpose just so they seem more popular than they really are. It's obvious that the mob killed Kennedy. And I think that expiration dates on food are just a conspiracy by Kraft and the FDA to get you to buy condiments before you need to.
So here's what struck me there. It seems to me that there are a couple of lines there that could be lines, could be jokes, could be tweets, like the Trader Joe's. Your suspicion that Trader Joe has small parking lots on purpose. That's a funny concept, yeah. Right? But to fit it inside this larger structure, it becomes something more. So did it start with that observation about the specific observations, or did it start with the conceit and then the observations were filled in?
It started by just going to Trader Joe's. I mean, I'll be honest with you. To go like, this is ridiculous. You know you're a popular grocery store. I don't even know if it translates here in New York or where. Like,
yeah, got a couple Trader Joe's.
But driving in there and you're like, you know you're a popular grocery store and I know you just opened up and now you got 8 spots for the 40 cars trying to be like, okay. So everybody drives by like, whoa, what's going on? But I am a conspiracy theorist. I get into all that stuff.
You have this Trader Joe's observation. At what point do you say, well, this is kind of a conspiracy theory? Or is it more like you're talking to conspiracy theorists and you're saying to yourself, well, there was that thought I had about Trader Joe's.
Well, just from a pure joke writing standpoint, yeah. I'm like, I think this is, it's marketing. It's not a conspiracy theory. It's like, oh, this is a marketing theory.
Yes.
It's much funnier to put it out as a conspiracy theory of minimal proportions,
yes.
As opposed to like, oh, their way of advertising is to seem like they're like falsely popular. But to call it a conspiracy theory and you're like the guy in the shadows going, I'll tell you the real truth. That's what makes it a joke.
Yes.
Instead of like, here's a marketing strategy a company put forth.
And then
that's not funny at all.
And then there are other grace notes in there where you describe yourself. It's akin to the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. You know, you couldn't even play with the other reindeers. So, I mean, there's the superstructure. There's the specific examples. There are some kind of side pathways of analogy. There's a lot going on there. I mean, to the audience, hell, if you interpret it like this, you're not going to enjoy yourself. But there is writing. Like, really, there's a lot of choices and a lot of writing going on there, I think.
Well, how many people do you think, like, take out the physical act of writing and think of your friends that know how to just get a ball rolling just mentally for themselves, get them worked up about something, and then mentally they're getting a little more confident with what they're talking about, so their descriptions get more vivid as they're telling you about the best sandwich they ate or how terrible traffic was, and then you know they're starting to exaggerate some of the details because you're laughing at them. So the stories get a little, I mean, it's a big fish story, but you're not trying to win. You're not trying to fool anybody. You're just trying to make them laugh.
Yeah.
And that's everybody I grew up with. If you were pissed or had a bad day and you wanted to complain about it to somebody else, it better be entertaining. You can't just complain. Otherwise, it's selfish. But if you're making somebody laugh, you're complaining, you're venting, and somebody else is being entertained by it. So you're killing two birds with one stone. If you want to call that writing, even though there's no pen to paper or fingers to keypad, that's the writing process.
And then perhaps the greatest success of all, Trader Joe's hears you and adds 2 more spots. But they're handicapped, so you can't use them.
Just give me a discount for the free press. That's what I just want, free
but
stuff.
But it's free bad press. I know Trump has proved that doesn't matter.
Hey, everything's on its end nowadays, all right? You know, You just disparage somebody as much as you can and be like, you know what? We'll take it. He's got our name in the zeitgeist. Let's give him some coupons.
Kyle Kinane's Loose in Chicago special aired October 15th. We'll continue to air on the Comedy Central site. Anything else you want to plug?
If you like my bad conspiracy theories, I got a podcast called The Boogie Monster that I host with my friend Dave Stone. We really have absolutely zero focus on it. Don't go to it for facts. We start talking about Bigfoot, but then we get into fried chicken recipes. It's really all over the place. But I'm just out there. Probably coming to your city soon. So
Kyle Kinane, coming to a city soon. Also, I loved you in Love.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. Great.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kyle. Good to meet you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
And now the spiel. Mariachi bands on the subway do not have the biggest repertoire. They've got the cucaracha, they've got the Mexican hat dance, and that's about it. I guess not too many extra requests come in. The distance between any one line doesn't call for more songs than that. That's what they got. But you know what? The Mexican hat dance is a really good song. Da-dun, da-dun. Here it's just building. Da-da-da-da-dun, da-dun. Okay, da-dun. Say what? Da-dun, uh-huh. Da-da-da-da-dun, da-dun. Now you're primed. You're ready for it to kick in, and man doesn't. You play it. You can play it. It builds. It crests. It was once banned by colonial and religious authorities as considered to be morally offensive, a challenge to Spain's control. However, what happens? What happens when you ban the Mexican hat dance? People will protest. People will rebel. People will hold illegal dances. On the subway, they will play the hat dance. Ba-dump, ba-dump. It's a good song. I'm just saying we take the Mexican hat dance for granted. If it didn't exist and I was demoing it for you, you'd be like, that is a good song. Some songs are just songs because they're songs. Like, is Happy Birthday good? Is Happy Birthday bad? It's just Happy Birthday. But the Mexican hat dance is solid. It doesn't get the credit it deserves. Which brings me in some way to the Antan Twig. The Antan Twig is our name for a 3-week period. Over 3 weeks, we sometimes make mistakes, we sometimes get complaints, and we definitely give awards. So what we do is we clean out the air filter that is our inbox. And I have made a number of mistakes. See, I thought that I was on solid ground when I evoked the name of that feces-splattering honker from north of the border. No, not Rob Ford, the Canadian goose. Aha. It's the Canada goose. They use not the adjectival form, but the attributive noun form. Now, why would I say the Canadian goose and not the Canada goose? I don't know. Because of the Brazilian tinamou, the Patagonian tinamou, the New Britain sparrowhawk, the Sumatran laughing thrush, the Cambodian laughing thrush, the American widgeon, the American black duck, the American woodcock. Perhaps I let the woodcock be my guide. Not the America woodcock, the American woodcock. I would not block that woodcock by calling it an America woodcock. It's proud to be an American. At least it knows it's free, but doesn't know it's a woodcock. And could it answer, how much cock could a woodcock block if a woodcock could block cock? Yes, stop it, I will. Okay. Almost all species are named after the adjective. Some are named after the noun, like the Canada goose. I got it wrong, and thus became the laughing thrush of an entire people. An ornithologically
persnickety people. Canada Goose was the number two comment that I got. Number one was a lot of people wrote in saying, actually, my podcast player can play back at 3x speed. I did this experiment where I tried to get, if you use Apple, that's what I use, if you use that iTunes player, you can only go to 2x speed. So I played some of our podcast at 1.5x speed and then recommended you play it at 2x speed to achieve 3x speed. I found out a lot of you could achieve 3x speed on your own. There is still no way to achieve 5x speed, is there? The math just doesn't work. And if you do, I mean, think about American literature. I mean, Hemingway's For Humberto and Henry James, The Turn of the Screw. And of course, Maya Angelou's marvelous I Know Que Person. Frank Ordia, a former classics professor, wrote to correct my references to the 7 labors of Hercules. Duh. There were 12 labors, of course. Among them, the Nemean lion, the Lernaean hydra, the Cretan bull, the Stymphalian birds, the Augean stable. I bring this up for 2 reasons. One, those are all adjectives. Augean, Stymphalian, Cretan. I'm just saying. I like to hold on to things. 2, I was always fascinated by that myth of the Augean stable. It is a myth where Hercules has to clean up poop. It is about cleaning up poop. The livestock poops. Hercules cleans it up. As soon as he cleans it up, they poop again. It is not a feat of strength. It is not a battle with the undead. It is about cleaning up poop. Lots and lots of poop. Myths have given us so many phrases. The sword of Damocles, the Midas touch, and Achilles' heel. This one has given us same shit, different day. I love the Augean stables myth. I want to invent an entire genre of myths about lesser god and goddesses whose only job was to deal with the bodily functions of the gods we know. Like, you think Pegasus is housebroken? He's not. Or how about the lesser-known god, Charmanites? Charmanites, you know him, his job was to wipe the centaur's ass. Yeah, you ever think of that? The centaur, picture him, right? Torso of a man, body of a horse, but think about the arms of the man. They don't reach all the way back to the way back of the horse. Horses go on for a long time. It's just physiology, people. Centaurs, great archers, not when they got a little business back there. That's where Charmanites comes in. And now to the Lobstar. Russell Cobb wrote in, a lot of people did, about the story of Fly Day when I pitched that in the Eel Tank, a day, a short story that I may be writing about one day in everyone's life where they could fly. Here were Russell Cobb's questions as he wrote to us on Facebook.com/SlateGist. He wrote, 1, if Fly Day ends while you're flying, do you fall to the ground? 2, does it ever happen that someone's Fly Day happens to be the day they're dying of natural causes? If so, can they fly while they're dead? Or is that a spinoff of Fly Day with zombies? The answer to that's no, they're just dead. It's not magic, it's flying. 3, he surmises there are subreddits about who really controls Fly Day, like Putin. Maybe Putin created Fly Day as a ruse to infiltrate American democracy. No, that's insane, Russell. And yet, I don't want to snuff out your spirit of inquiry. I want to elevate it. And that's why you, Russell Cobb, asking all the right questions, are the Lobstar of this Antan Twig. And that's it for today's show. The Gist was produced by Mary Wilson. She is interbreeding an Amsterdam albatross with a Madagascar cuckoo hawk. This is a bird that gets crazy high. Chris Berube, Gist producer, is combining a Sri Lankan hanging parrot with an Arabian babbler, a bird that wants to talk but knows the high price he'll pay. Steve Lichtai, executive producer of Slate Podcasts, is breeding a lesser Antillean peewee with the great-billed kingfisher. The new species will be known as the medium, kind of whatever, sort of sparrow. Andy Bowers, chief content officer of the Panoply Network. He's got a Pacific loon. He's mating it with a Filipino bulbul. And he's hoping to create Rodrigo Duterte. The Gist, I got an African spoonbill, hoping to mate it with a fork-tailed stormy petrel. I don't want a new bird. I just want a cutlery set. Oomperu deperu duperu. And thanks for listening. Give the gift of Slate Plus to another Slate fan in your life. He or she will receive all the benefits of membership, like ad-free podcasts, bonus podcast segments, and access to the Slate Academies. It's also another way to support Slate's independent journalism. Give Slate Plus today at slate.com/giveplus.